Can you hear me? Appreciate so many people in our church. It takes a lot to be in a different building and still seamlessly switch over. So thankful we have so many hands. Grateful for our church, especially those of you behind the scenes. If you have a Bible, let's turn to Psalm 90. We are finishing our summer in Psalms this morning, and it just so happens this is the only psalm attributed to Moses. So our last psalm of the summer will actually be the oldest psalm. So thing. That song we just sang, was that anybody's first time singing that? Abide with me, people. It's one of my favorites. I have it framed in our house. It has the theme of our sermon today in it. It says, change and decay all around I see. O thou who changest not, abide with me. We all know that to be true. God is our abiding, everlasting God. That's the theme of Psalm 90. So if you found it, let's stand and read it together. Psalm 90, a prayer of Moses, the man of God. Lord, you have been our dwelling place in all generations, before the mountains were brought forth. Forever you had formed the earth and the world, from everlasting to everlasting, you are God. You return man to dust and say, return, O children of man, for 1,000 years in your sight are but as yesterday when it is past, or as a watch in the night. You sweep them away as with a flood. They are like a dream, like grass that is renewed in the morning. In the morning it flourishes and is renewed. In the evening it fades and withers. For we are brought to an end by your anger. By your wrath we are dismayed. You set our iniquities before you, our secret sins in the light of your presence. For all our days pass away under your wrath. We bring our years to an end like a sigh. The years of our life are 70, or even by reason of strength, 80. Yet their span is but toil and trouble. They're soon gone, and we fly away. Who considers the power of your anger and your wrath according to the fear of you? So teach us to number our days that we may get a heart of wisdom. Return, O Lord, how long? Have pity on your servants. Satisfy us in the morning with your steadfast love, that we may rejoice and be glad all our days. Make us glad for as many days as you have afflicted us, and for as many years as we have seen evil. Let your work be shown to your servants and your glorious power to their children. Let the favor of the Lord our God be upon us, and establish the work of our hands upon us. Yes, establish the work of our hands. Thank you. Have your seat. In this psalm, it appears Moses is later in his earthly life, possibly near the end of the wilderness wanderings where he's leading the children of Israel. And most of the psalm, he is reflecting on years past. He's looking back. And Moses gives us a rather sober view of the reality of life. He doesn't have rose-colored glasses on. There's kind of this godly honesty that he says. My pastor growing up, I bet he said it every Sunday. You quoted Job. The man's days are few and full of trouble. That's what Moses says. But I hope you heard, even as we just read it, that in Moses' reflection, looking over life, he does not fail to see that standing over and above and in this short, brief, troublesome life is his God, the sovereign God who is over all of it. And so this reflection, he doesn't move to doubt or despair. This reflection on the brevity of life and how difficult it is, it moves him, because of who his God is, to pray, to seek the Lord, to be with him, to abide with him, and to help make the most of just a few days that he may have left. And I'm thankful that this song landed on my Sunday. Or I kind of actually just took it one way or another. It was going to be nice. It was good for me. It's good for me to just as a light to my path, as God's Word is. It led me and helped me in the last couple weeks. But I want you to see that this is mainly not an individual text. Moses didn't say any I's or me's. He said, our days. This is a psalm that it's meant for us together to collectively think about our days together and seek the Lord as a body, as a church, as a people of God. Use the rest of our days for His glory. So, the text, I've broken into two sections. There's this reflection, Moses looking back on life, and that causes him to pray. It moves him to ask God for things. So verses 1 through 11 are his reflection. Verse 1, it begins with him reflecting on God's provision for his people. And God has been this dwelling place for all generations. There's many generations as he looks back over the people of Israel and God's people all the way back through Abraham. They're born and they live and they die. But not only while they live, they don't just live, they live almost like pilgrims and sojourners. Most of all, as he looks back, they never really had a place. Think of Abraham. He went, left his father's house not knowing where he was going. They're always, it seems, a little distance from security. Think about Moses himself. He lived in luxury in Pharaoh's palaces. The Hebrews tell us that he chose rather to leave peace and security and a home to go out and wander in the desert. Think about that. He never had it. Moses is made of the same stuff that we are. Every one of us have this longing to be more settled, to have a place of belonging, to have peace and security in our days. But as Moses wakes up every morning as he writes the song, think about his life. He wakes up in these makeshift tents in anything but a familiar place. It's like as soon as their tent gets settled and they start being familiar, the cloud raises up and like we're off again. They know nothing of peace and security. What is the home? What is the eternal dwelling of God's people? He says, you, God, you are our home. Even if we are never settled, even if we have no home on this earth, we are always at home because we are your people. You provide everything we need. Remember this, even when Moses is told by God, I'm going to send you guys into the promised land. After they sin, God says, go on. You take the people. I'm going to let you go. Go into the promised land. He even says, I'm going to kick out all the nations. And you're going to get the land. It's going to be flowed with milk and honey. But I'm not going with you because I will consume you with my wrath. Do you remember what Moses says? He doesn't say, well, I mean, as long as we get a great place, right? As long as I have my forever home. He says, if you won't go with us, I'm not going. Can we say that? Do you have a longing for always a little bit more settled? I just want a little bit more of an at-home feel. The world promises much to us in that. It is always trying to sell you a little bit more peace and security. And God gives a promise in Hebrews of how to fight that. He says, be careful of the love of money. Be content with what you have, for I will never leave you. That is the antidote to always trying to find a little bit more settledness here. God is the eternal dwelling place of his people. Augustine, we learned, I'm sure you remember this history highlight, way back early church history, said, you have made us for yourself, O Lord, and so we are restless until we have found our rest in you. God is the home of his people. We are at home because we have him. Now Moses then, after verse, well, he looks at the mountains, think of the most stable, permanent thing he could see. The mountains and earth that you have formed, it literally says brought forth, like before they were even born. You, God, are eternal. This eternal home that we have. But Moses, in verse 3, he takes this sobering shift in his reflection. He begins to consider death. And not just death, but it seems like the point of what he's saying is the speed at which it comes. Look at verse 3. You return man to dust and say, return, O children of man. Our mind should immediately go to Genesis, where he says, from dust I made you, and now because of your sin, back to dust you will return. God calling mankind back to death. And it's not like it takes forever to get there, is what Moses keeps thinking about. It happens so fast. In verse 4, he says, 1,000 years to the Lord. And yet imagine our 60, 70, 80 years. He says, it's like a watch in the night. 3-hour window in the middle of the night when we're all sleeping. It's over like that. He gives three kind of pictures in verse 5 of what it's like. Our brief few days, he says, you sweep them away as with a flood. The flood is one of the most terrifying things in their time. Think about those floods in Texas the other day. Without notice, all of a sudden, the water comes and takes it all away. That is how death comes to people. Their life is there, and then all of a sudden, it is not. He says it's like a dream, where you're in a dream in the middle of the night, and you're riding a flying elephant. That wasn't in my notes. The dream feels so real. I'm just living there forever. And the moment you wake up, you can barely remember it. It was so brief. I can't even recall all of it. That, he says, is what our days are like. So temporary, so passing. And then he says it's like grass. In the morning, I guess that's how the grass is in parts of Israel. In the morning, it springs up. It's green and it flourishes. And it's like this grass, it's going to last forever. Doesn't even make it 24 hours before it fades and withers. Now remember, Moses is looking back and reflecting on experience. He has seen this. Any of us who have lived any amount of time, we know this to be true, don't we? How fast it goes. Time just slips through your fingers. You wake up, and it's like, where did the last 10 years go? Surely our lives are a vapor, is what the scriptures say. This dream will soon be over. Olive was looking out the window, and as we're walking in, this graveyard around us is good for us every week to walk in and see. Those people, they were walking in just like we were, living and feeling like, I've got so much time. And so soon, like a dream, we will be there, and others will be walking in our place. I've never met an 80-year-old person that said, it just went so slow. It took forever to get here. We went to the nursing home on Friday to the bungalows. They like Lucas a lot more. And this fragile old lady, probably in her 80s, she said, I still feel like I'm a teenager. That's what we all feel like, right? No matter the aches and pains, no matter the gray hairs that come, it was so fast. Now, I said in the beginning that Moses, this has not caused him despair. He sees God as over and above and in all of this brevity of life. He is no deist like Thomas Jefferson. Thomas Jefferson said God, he kind of like got the world spinning like a top, and then he stands back kind of aloof, like it's just working out. We'll see what happens. I don't know, death or whatever's happening. Now, did you catch who it is that causes us to come back to death so soon? God says, return, O man, to dust. You sweep them away as with a flood. It is God who calls us back. It is not the devil. It is not our own decision. It is God who says, return to dust, O man. But even more alarming, maybe, we haven't got there yet. Why? Why is it that God is calling us back to death? Why are our years so short? Why don't we get to live forever on earth? Verse 7 says, for we are brought to an end by your anger. By your wrath we are dismayed. It's anger. It's wrath. It's judgment. That is why our lives are so short. Let's keep reading verse 8. You have set our iniquities before you, our secret sins in the light of your presence. For all our days pass away under your wrath. We bring our years to an end like a sigh. The years of our life are 70, or even by reason of strength 80, yet their span is but toil and trouble. They are soon gone, and we fly away. God calls us to death. And we ask the question, why? Moses looks back and sees the brevity of life and his toil and struggle. What does he give the ultimate reason for? Sin. Every achy joint, every diagnosis, every another Israelite falling in the wilderness, Moses makes a direct correlation back. He says, all of this is our sin. All of death, all of suffering is to make my mind immediately go back to sin. And this is the hardest part of the text to wrestle with. Just what exactly is in Moses' mind by the Holy Spirit. You think on Moses and the children of Israel. The anger and wrath of God was not something they just read about. It wasn't like a classroom subject out to debate about it. He was going to write a thesis about the wrath of God. Let's talk about it and debate it. God's wrath was revealed from heaven to them in tangible, terrifying ways. They saw it and heard it. They heard men screaming in agony as venom from snakes coursed through their veins, and they were dying. Because they groaned. See the connection? He saw it every time. Moses saw the corpses of his nephews because they went into the holy place and profaned the worship of God. He saw this correlation. Death because of sin. There's a moment when God tells Moses, tell the Levites to go get their swords. And I want them to go tent by tent to everyone who set up the golden calf in idolatry. And I want you to kill your fathers and brothers. They saw that. Can you imagine the fear that they had? That's why Moses says, our God is a consuming fire. We struggle with this, don't we? The wrath of God can seem a conceptual idea. But imagine you saw these things. There would be no doubt every death you saw. It's interesting. If you do the math, in Israel, or in the wilderness, as they walked, they buried nearly 100 people every day. Why? Because God said, you will not go into the promised land. Your dead bodies will fall in the wilderness because of your grumbling, because of your unbelief. So constantly, Moses has this brevity of life before him. And every time it calls him to think, God is holy. We are not. But you say, this is what I wrestle with. You say, but Moses and Joshua and Caleb, they believe God. Why is this their reflection? Why are they saying anger and wrath? Right? Here's my best shot. You study and get back with me if you have something else. Moses and Joshua and Caleb, they are sinners, just like me and you. And they don't get a pass on experiencing the judgment of God corporately, the curse of God upon the world. Their years are marked the same as anyone else by toil, struggle, by the sweat of their brow, by pain in childbirth. They have experienced it, some of them. There's thorns and sweat, there's difficulty in relationships, wearisome, and burdens of life. They didn't get a pass. They buried loved ones. They witnessed funeral after funeral of people they loved and saw. And eventually they knew their own death. They did not get to skip and go straight to heaven. So in that way, they are no different. So what I see is verse 11 is kind of this hinge point of what is different about Moses and Joshua and Caleb. Their reflection, they think the same way. They look back and they see God is holy, and our life here is toil and struggle and sin. We feel God's wrath revealed from heaven against all iniquity, even the secret ones. He stops in verse 11 and says, "Who considers the power of your anger and your wrath according to the fear of you?" He says, every time we saw death and the judgment of God, it had a design. Remember, who was it that caused all that? Who was it that is bringing everybody to fall in the wilderness? It's God. Who was it in the garden that said, "Cursed be"? That was not Satan. God is the one that brought about toil and suffering and death because of sin for a purpose. There was a design in it so that as we reflect back, as we look and see how short life is and we watch our loved ones be put in the grave, it was meant to cause us to consider. We were meant to stop and think, not just about them, their life, but it was meant to turn us inward. Think, I need redemption. Every death, every sorrow, every burdensome day of work is meant to turn our hearts toward the Lord, not away. If that concept seems fuzzy, I'll give a New Testament example. Just toil, the groaning of creation, that God set it up that way to cause us to seek Him. If that seems fuzzy, there's another example Jesus gives. I thought of this. He says, there's some Galileans that Pilate murdered. They suffered terribly, and he mixed their blood with some kind of sacrifices. And he said, there's another story in the headlines that you knew about. A tower fell and crushed people. What was it that Jesus expected us, or those people, what should have happened in their hearts? He said, don't think about them. Well, like, was it their sin or what was the fault? He said, every tragedy, every headline like that, every death and funeral like that, he said, should make you think about your own life. He said, except you repent, you will likewise perish. All of the toil, all of the struggle, all the brevity of life, God so woven it into our daily existence to push you to it. So here's a super practical question. Has the toil and weariness, frailty and brevity of life been especially apparent to you lately? Work, in your home, in your family, how are you responding? What does it do for you? Jesus said in the parable of the sowers, it can act like thorns in it. It can choke out the fruitfulness of the word and turn you away from God. But this psalm says it is designed to push you. The waves are to push you to the rock of Christ. This was the food for my soul in the last couple weeks. Felt like this choking out just some burdens and the weariness. God says, this is to lead you to me. It is to humble you, see your self-sufficiency. It is to humble you to see your own sinfulness and desperation for mercy and grace from God. I just think Jesus saying, come, all you weary and heavy laden, and I will give you rest. I always thought he was talking to like a subset of people, like the real tired ones over there. They're just worn out all the time. And he's talking to all of us. Weary under the sin-sick world, despair and toil of life. And Jesus says, all of that is meant so I can gather you as the chicks under my wings. And so, that's exactly what it does for Moses. You see that in our text. He reflects brevity of life. It is a sober life. But he does not despair. Look at verse 12. So, after reflecting, so teach us to number our days that we may get a heart of wisdom. See the brevity, I see the toil, and it has moved me to call out to God. I need you to help me not waste the days that I have. I think this numbering of our days is kind of the overarching prayer. All the others are just ways that that's explained out. Other things that he is asking for so that our days are fruitful and meaningful. Now, I don't think when he says, God, would you teach us to number our days? I don't think that means to literally count them. I counted out how many I had. 13,759. That's where I'm at yesterday. There's another one. I didn't count today. I don't think that's what he means. You need to count backwards. He kind of did that. He said, you might get 70 or at most 80 or so. That's not what he's saying, I don't think. I think he's saying, teach me that they are limited, that they have a number. Our temptation is to think there's just so many. Today is, you know, it's just another one. I'm going to get a million more. When you see that today is all I'm promised. It's all I have. It is limited. Me and Hunter were talking the other day, how precious Saturdays are. Have you felt this sometimes? It's the free day of the week. There's so much pressure. So much pressure. I'm going to mess it up. What do I do with my time? You sit there and you're like, oh, I could do this or this or this, and I end up wasting it. But is that. It is limited. I only get this one day. I'm going to use it. I'm going to throw it away. But the truth is, as you read that prayer, we know that life is short. That does not take being a Christian to know that. Every older person in the nursing home will tell you, life is short. We all feel our day slipping through our hands. This verse is proof that just knowing that life is short is not going to be enough to motivate you to use them for God's glory, to not waste them. We must pray. The easiest application of my text I found. He prays, Lord, you must teach me. That's what I was saying in the prayer meeting last week. I understand life is short. I see it. I don't always feel it. I don't always live like every moment must not be wasted. Jonathan Edwards wrote resolutions in his life. Resolve to do this. Resolve to not do this. And he said, I resolve to live as I shall wish I had done when I come to die. One of the pastors talking about, stand on the edge, the precipice of eternity, where the air is crystal clear. The value, the limitedness of our time, we will have no doubt at that point. And what Edwards is saying is, I want that now. Why do I throw so much time away? What will we think when we stand there and we look back and there's so much time where we're looking at a screen? Will that not grieve us? What time? It was so limited. It was so brief. and I wasted it, squandered it. We get no do-overs. So God, teach us. They are limited. I don't want to waste them. I was talking this text over with my wife. She's a good question asker. She's a practical girl. What does this mean? Tell me. She said, well, what does it mean? We're going to make the most of our life. We're not going to waste our days. Well, what does that look like tomorrow? The easiest thing I can do is, I think that's what he's asking for in the rest of the text. The rest of the requests are, as many days as I have left, I want this. Help me with this. This is how I'm not going to waste my days. So look what he asked for. I don't want to waste my days. Lord, verse 13, what does he ask for? First, this is precious for Moses. Return, O Lord. How long? Have pity on your servants. It comes full circle. Think Moses, he's living in a tent. He has nothing but today's provision. What does he ask for? More days? A nice house? Could we finally get to the promised land? More friends, more godly friends, safety. What does he ask for from God? He says, I want you, God. How long, O Lord? You are my home. You are what I want and need more than anything else. If my days are to be meaningful at all, I need you. I don't need stuff. I need you. Verse 14, 15. He asks for, he says this, verse 14. Satisfy us in the morning with your steadfast love that we may rejoice and be glad all our days. Make us glad for as many days as you have afflicted us and for as many years as we have seen evil. There's a simple request in what he's asking in verse 14 and 15. God, would you cause me to be satisfied and happy in you? Not in my place of mind. Not in my possessions. Not in anything else. Satisfied with your steadfast love. This unchanging has been bought and paid for in your Son's atoning work. Make me happy in that. George Mueller, the famous orphanage guy. What is an orphan runner guy? George Mueller, that's what he said. He said, the first and primary responsibility I have every day is to make myself happy in Jesus. You know this to be true. If I am to be of any worth, to be of any consequence, I need to find myself satisfied in God. If you want your days to count, go to the Scriptures. Check it off. Don't pray because you think you should. Go there every morning. He says in the morning, go there and say, God, I'm empty. I want to be satisfied in you today. I want the joy of the Lord to be my strength. You know that when it's true, right? When you are joyful in the Lord, your day is so prosperous. You can love endlessly. You can be patient. You can serve with the joy, with the strength that God supplies. What our grace needs, God satisfies. The Westminster Catechism says it like this. What is the chief end of man? Not just to glorify God. To glorify God and enjoy Him forever. It's what we were made for. You live our life in drudgery. Doing my duty, we are wrong. Our duty is to delight in God. It's what we were made for. It's what our days are made for. Steadfast love is better than life. And at his right hand are pleasures forevermore. That's why Paul prays for the church. This is what you need to know the love of Christ and be filled with all the fullness of God. That's what we need. More rejoicing. More gladness all our days. Satisfy us, God. And then he gets to what we do. So order there. What do We're supposed to do with our hands, our work. That's what I see in verse 16 and 17. Now notice the order of these requests. He's going to talk about the work we do with our hands. You got to establish them, to make them fruitful, to show us favor. But look what he asked for first. Lord, let your work be shown to your servants and your glorious power to their children. Probably most of us don't have a problem filling our time, do we? We can stay really, really busy. I have plenty of work. I have plenty of toil. I have plenty of things that I'm going to tackle. But it's not always worth it. It's not always something that's going to be, that I'm going to look back on my deathbed and say, that was worth a lot of time. What Moses asked for first is, God, I know you are doing things. I know you are working in the world. And I'm going to be tempted to go off and do my own work. Would you show me what you're doing? And I will just join in that. We don't have to make up what needs to be done. God is at work. We just need to join his work. So he asks him, Lord, let your work be shown. Let your glorious power. I'm going to come back to that one. And then he says, let the favor of the Lord our God be upon us and establish the work of our hands upon us. God, make our work, the things we do, put our effort and time and energy into, we still need to ask, bless it. Even the good works. Unless the Lord builds the house. It's good to build a house and a home and a church. But unless he is here, unless his favor rests on it, it is in vain. Not like, it's a really good thing, but it could have been better. It says, it is in vain. It will crumble. It will be like wood and straw that will burn up without his favor, without his blessing. Remember, there's a corporate prayer. Should this not be our regular theme in our prayer meeting? Oh, Lord. Trying to seek you or trying to join your work, let your favor rest upon it. You bless it. May it not fall to the ground. We need your blessing. C.T. Studd, he was like the LeBron James of his day. Could have been like a bajillionaire athlete. He gave it all up. He said that was fleeting. He said, only one life. 'Twill soon be past. Only what's done for Christ will last. That's my last point. It's very possible at this time in Moses' life, just thinking about this, he may already know he's not going to make it to the promised land. He's already been told, you struck the rock. You dishonored me before the people. You didn't uphold me as holy. You're not going to get into the promised land. But I think what's so amazing about Moses, because he grasps, my life is this short little blip on eternity. I have a small piece to play. It's not all about me. It's not about my time. My temptation would be like, well, I'm done then. I'm going to go back to Egypt or do something worth my while. I've only got a few days left. You notice what Moses does all the way up to the end. He leads the children of Israel all the way up to the Jordan River, and he is urging them. When you get over there, I'm not going to be there. I don't get to go. My brief life, it can serve God's purposes. It can fulfill his work, and I never get to even see. We talk about the promised land. He's like 40 years. Imagine what it's going to be like. And he never even gets to see it. But he doesn't walk off and go home. That's the kind of church, people of God, we ought to be. Our life is brief. We may not get to see Bethany be whatever is in your mind. But I can serve in this place and I can push it one step along. And maybe my kids get to see it and I'm just in heaven just rejoicing at it. We can be that. Our life is brief. Plow and do what we can because he said, I want your power to be shown to the next generation. I want to see it and taste and experience it, but my life can affect the next one and that's okay. I can see it. I'll plant an oak tree. I never get to sit under its shade, but it's for the next generation. I close with this picture. This is a story that stuck with me. There's a man by the name of Ichabod Spencer. He pastored Jonathan Edwards Church in Northampton like a century later. But he has a book. It's worth reading. It's a book, it's like sketches of anxious inquirers, if they help you write them back then, the title of the book. He's a pastor, and he details out people coming in troubled about their soul. And he writes down how he counsels them and how they either walk away or come to faith. And I say this example saying, every one of us thinking about this, looking at the toil and brevity of life, and how that's supposed to lead us to God and not away from Him. Ichabod Spencer tells a story of this young man in his church that comes to him, and he's anxious about his soul. He fears the judgment to come, and it is moving him. But he says, "My work, I'm just so busy. I will never become a Christian or be serious about my faith unless I could just get rid of all toil, all struggle, and go just me and the Bible in the woods for weeks on end. Then I will become a Christian." You feel that sometimes? This toil, it's just, if I just didn't have that, then I would be serious. Then I would be all in. When I get this project done, when we get past this toil, this hard season, I said that. Ichabod Spencer rightly, I think, counsels him, "Don't do that. You will not find God apart from toil." But he ignores his counsel. He goes and gets in the cabin. He sits with his Bible for 3 weeks. When he comes back, he says, "My heart is so wicked." He says, "If I cannot come to God in my toil, I will never come to Him alone." And he went back to his job, went back to his toil, and in his toil, it turned his heart to the Lord, and he came to faith. So whether you're not a Christian, let the ringing of every time your vehicle has to stop in the road and the hearses go by, let all of that call to mind every time, "God is holy, I am not. Flee to Christ who absorbed all the wrath in your stead." The only steadfast love we get that Moses gets is because all the wrath that I deserve fell on him. And I get to walk in and take his righteousness. Steadfast love falls on me. But if you feel busy, if the toil is feeling overwhelming, don't let it choke out the word. Run to God in the toil. Let's pray. Lord, surely it will be like a sigh, and we will be standing before your presence. We'll remember this day, thinking about Psalm 90. Oh God, may not one of us sitting here be careless over our remaining days. Cause us to be more earnest, more urgent. As you peel back where we are wasting days, God, would you satisfy us with your steadfast love and make us the most joyful and rejoicing churches. This people be content. You are our home. You are an everlasting dwelling. Deepen our sense of eternity. Like Edward says, stamp eternity in our eyes, God. How prone we are to waste precious time. Would you change us by your Spirit, God? Pray all this in Jesus' name. Amen. All right.